I want to introduce our topic today by talking about the concept of stress testing. And what I'm referring to is something that we've seen necessary by banks and financial institutions. I mean, we've had some high-profile situations where people go to the bank to withdraw some money and, sorry, we don't have enough of your money ready right now, maybe try again later. We don't tend to think very positively about this, and people are kind of sensitive about not being allowed to take out something that belongs to them because perhaps it wasn't managed very well, or perhaps there were some conditions that were somewhat foreseeable, but the person entrusted with your money just didn't prepare for them adequately. We don't accept this as just part of life and there's nothing we can do about it. We don't accept poor stress testing. And so I want to talk about this not simply from the point of view of a financial institution. We have other ways, all areas of life, that we require excellence in stress testing. That is, preparation for adverse conditions, not simply for the run-of-the-mill average good days. We have to be ready for some adversity. Now, I want to talk about this in terms of another example that might seem a little more relatable physically. When a bridge falls down, we recognize there are limits to what the bridge was prepared to endure. This happened recently, and I'm not being critical of the people who built the bridge. I've heard it suggested that the bridge in Baltimore that fell, there's probably no bridge on earth that could have sustained that kind of impact. I don't know whether that's true or not, but that's certainly not the kind of condition that we would ordinarily expect a bridge to be ready for. But something it brings to our mind, however, is that there are limits to what the bridge is expected to be able to endure. There are definitely some conditions that will make it fall down. Now, suppose on the other hand that we're building a new bridge, and that's going to come up from time to time, even in any town USA or a place near you. So suppose there's a place that's building a new bridge, and the bridge is about ready to open for the public. They've done some testing on it, and they've determined that it's assessed to be safe under certain conditions. For example, what if they've tested it with very light loads, not letting a tremendous amount of weight that would normally be put on that bridge, but they stress it with one vehicle at a time under mild weather conditions. Winds are light, temperatures are favorable. Well, we don't look at that as ready for the public yet, right? It's going to have to stand up to a little more difficult testing than that. Now, on the other hand, they may tell you, okay, now we've tested the bridge and it's ready even under normal loads of traffic. Okay, so say it's ready for the average amount of weight you might expect on it at a given time on a given day. Now, that sounds a bit better than what we heard the first time, but perhaps that's not entirely ready for public use, because what hasn't been tested at that point is what about heavy loads under high winds? What about heavy loads during challenging weather? Maybe there's temperatures that would be stressful to the materials and the makeup of that bridge. And so if there are too many people on it at the same time under those conditions, we don't know if the bridge would stand up or not. Now, I'm not really interested in bridges after this point in our study today, but I want to make a point that a lot of times people try to make assessments of their faith based on favorable conditions. Many times people find it easy to dismiss outcomes that were quite unfavorable and they don't reflect well on us. But it's easy to dismiss it because, after all, I was going through a lot. After all, I was tired. I was upset. I was afraid. There's no end of excuses you could make under many of those situations. And in fact, it's also easy to talk about this in terms of raising your children. Sometimes you might find it easy to make excuses for poor behavior because, after all, little Billy is tired, or he's hungry, he's been upset, he's been through a lot. We've asked a lot of him. That may be true, but there's really not going to be an end of excuses you could make for the child. What he ultimately needs to learn is how to behave even under unfavorable conditions, because life is not going to stop throwing multiple challenges at him as he gets older. And at some point, he's going to have to learn to deal with that too. We don't do well when we just dismiss those outcomes without learning from them in our own lives, even as adults either. Now, as we say this, that we don't accept poor stress testing results in life, God doesn't accept poor stress testing results either. Now, one of the Proverbs we studied recently is from 24, verse 10, and I believe it speaks to the subject a bit, as he says, "If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small." Now, I think a lot of people would find it very easy to say, but after all, it was adversity. After all, those were very challenging conditions. And we tend to make excuses for each other. And we've probably all heard it suggested that, don't worry, I've heard these very words, and I'm sure you have too. We won't be judged based on our worst moments. Well, I'm not entirely sure what is meant when people say that sometimes. Because yes, of course, we need God's grace. We have weaknesses. But we're not excused just to dismiss those without trying to do better, without learning from them, and not repeating the same mistakes. Because after all, I don't find that concept taught in the Bible. Your worst moments, however, reveal something that you weren't prepared for. And that's really what I want to talk about in our lesson today. But then on the other hand, before we jump into this, I want to read from Hebrews 10, starting in verse 36. With an Old Testament reference there. And keep in mind that this is written to brethren who have been enduring persecution. They've endured a lot of persecution that I've never come close to having to face, so, at least so far in my life. But what is said of them here is that there were steps of which they weren't prepared to go. And in chapter 12, it clarifies that they had not yet suffered to the point of giving their lives. And that seems to be a step they weren't ready to take. Hebrews 10, verse 36 says, "You have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay, but my righteous one shall live by faith." Now note the rest of our reading here. "If he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but those who have faith and preserve their souls." Now these are very helpful verses to us in terms of the subject we want to talk about today. Jesus continues this same thought in the Sermon on the Mount regarding the two builders, the two houses that seem to be of exactly the same quality, except for the foundations that they stood on. Because as he speaks there in those verses in Matthew 7, that the one who hears the words of Christ and does them is like the one who builds his house upon the rock. But then in the contrast of this is one who does not adhere to God's teaching, to the teaching of Christ. He's like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. But then what reveals the quality of that house was not the average condition from one day to another. It was when the winds came, the floods came, and they slammed against that house and it fell, and great was its fall. That is the one that was built on the sand. Now, we wouldn't accept this in a house that we were going to buy as well. That is, if you were to be introduced to a home by someone working for you, building the house, and suppose he were to tell you that 99% of the days in a year, this house will not leak, it won't have any walls fall down, the floors will stand up, and it won't flood. 99%, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, not really. That's about, what, 3 to 4 days a year? You might be expected to face some conditions that house is not built to stand up to. I don't think any one of us would buy that. But, you know, 99%, you know, don't judge a house based on its worst moments. Buy the house based on the more favorable conditions. Now, that's not good advice, and we don't accept that. And my suggestion to you today is that God doesn't accept this either. Because what's revealed in those adverse conditions is so valuable to us, we would be foolish to ignore and to dismiss those. Because when your faith is strained to the point that outcomes reflect poorly on you, don't dismiss it. Learn from it. Make corrections if you need to. But certainly, our faith will be stress tested. And it'll be stress tested in a variety of ways. And there is no way in one lesson we can really cover all of this into satisfaction. So I want to talk about it in certain ways. I want to talk about it in terms of pressure to compromise. That could take various forms, including persecution. It would also consider times when we have challenges of an emotional sort, or when we're tempted to make other very serious moral compromises in either deliberate acts or in terms of neglect. Our faith will be stress tested, and these are the ways I want to talk about it today. There's certainly other ways that we could include and could consider at some other time, but in terms of our lesson today, I want to talk about it in this way. Now, as we talk about it as our faith that's being stress tested, I'm not talking about your mere belief in God, and I'm not talking about it in terms of just whether or not someone is persuading you to completely abandon anything that reflects our overall conviction of Christ. What I'm talking about is a more inclusive way that the Bible refers to faith oftentimes as your set of convictions, the set of principles that you rely on in order to please God, to guide you through a life of uncertainty and into the world beyond. That's what really makes up our faith. It's that set of convictions and how firmly you're determined and committed to holding on to those no matter what challenges you may face. So let's start with the first one here. There's the pressure to compromise. And clearly, one of the most obvious ways that this will be presented to us is in terms of persecution. And certainly this is something that the Hebrew brethren knew a bit about. Now, more on that in a moment. But you see, the parable of the sower is also a situation that discusses some of this and from a couple of different angles that will be useful to us in our study today. But you know how common it is that someone will be so ready to receive the word. It says in Mark 4, receives the word immediately with joy, but doesn't have the kind of root that is going to be required, because it says they last for a while, but then when tribulation or persecution arises on account of the word, immediately they fall away. In other words, it starts to become a little bit more than they signed up for, and their faith wasn't prepared to endure that kind of pressure. But one of the more sobering contrasts, I think, on this subject involves the Hebrew brethren, the ones that we read about just a moment ago. Because as you look in chapter 10, we see that in verse 32 and so on, that these brethren have already been through a lot. A lot has been asked of them. And just to sum up some of that in Hebrews 10, it says that you were willing to endure a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, sometimes partners with those so treated. That is, they weren't even afraid to be associated with those that had been thrown in prison. It says that they had had their possessions confiscated, and they were willing to endure this. Now, the Lord doesn't make that observation and just disregard it. But what they have not been willing to do so far is revealed in chapter 12, because he says, you have not yet resisted sin to the point of shedding your blood. Now, I can't say that as someone who's had to do that myself either. But you see, it's very sobering to realize that there is a shortfall that was revealed by their unwillingness to stand up to that level of persecution. They weren't willing to give their lives. And this is shown in such contrast to the heroes of faith in Hebrews 11. That's the standard that is set for them. Hebrews 11, verse 13 says, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. It says that it was clear to them that they were seeking another homeland. That is, there is a city that is prepared for them. And this is the type of whom God says he is not ashamed to be called their God. This is also the ones that it says a bit later in the chapter that these were those who had been stoned. They were sawn in two. They were killed with a sword. They went about in sheepskins and skins of goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered about in caves and dens of the earth. These are the ones who were not so in love with this world that they were unwilling to give up everything, including their very lives. Now that's the standard God accepts, or God expects of us. And as we had just read at the end of chapter 10, he has no pleasure in one who shrinks back from that level of pressure. This is the martyr spirit that's also discussed in Revelation 12, verse 11, concerning those who resisted Satan and his allies, that they conquered him through the blood of the Lamb, for they loved not their lives even unto death. Even if death was required, they weren't ready or willing to compromise. That shows a level of faith that's challenging to us, but it's not just simply reserved or expected of someone else. This is what God requires of us as well, not to deny him, even if your life is on the line. Now, there's other types of pressure that's a little more, we'll say, softer pressure. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to lose your life itself or your health, but there's the social pressure sometimes. You might call it peer pressure. That is a desire to fit in, an unwillingness to stand to your principles and your convictions, some form or fashion of compromising the truth in order to keep the peace. That we see this sometimes in family relationships. We have situations where people need to hear the truth, or they need to understand the error of their way, and yet if we shrink back from showing them that we mean what we say when we call ourselves Christians, it's another form of shrinking back. Now, the Bible has a lot to say about this topic as well. And we know from John 9 that there was a man who was born blind, and Jesus had healed him of that blindness. And although that man and his parents all understood very well what had happened, the Jews weren't ready to accept this, that Jesus had healed this man of his blindness. And so they go in and they interview the parents, and they ask them to confirm that it was, in fact, as he had said. And they were willing to say, yes, he once was blind and now he's not, but we don't know what happened. We're not going to say why he's now able to see. But it clarifies that they weren't unaware of what really had taken place there. It says that they were afraid of the Jews. In chapter 9, verse 22, 23, it says that they were afraid that if they confessed Jesus to be the Christ, they would be put out of the synagogue. Now that doesn't put them in very good company, does it? If you consider what was said in John 12, that there are those who were even of Jewish authorities, those of the rulers of the Jews, that following the cumulative effect of all the miracles that Christ had worked, leading up shortly before his crucifixion, and even the raising of Lazarus from the dead. It says in John 12, verse 42, there were many of those authorities who believed in him, but for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, so they wouldn't be put out of the synagogue. Now, that's a social pressure of sorts, and it is a form of persecution. But you see, the way that the Lord views this is really clarified in verse 43. For they loved the glory that comes from men more than the glory that comes from God. Let it not be said of us that this kind of pressure is willing, or that we're willing to fold under it. Now, social pressure affects us many times more than we're ready to admit, more than we'd like to admit. And one of the horror stories of this includes the encounter of John the Baptist with Herod, because when John had been put into prison, he made some enemies as he had taught the truth for the reasons that he was there. But then, as you understand, that Herod's wife asked for the head of John, meaning for John to be put to death out of her hatred of him. It says the king knew not to do this. He didn't even want to do it. But you understand in Mark 6, verse 26, that because of his oaths, that is, he had promised to give a blank check to fulfill on behalf of this girl and her mother, but because of her oaths and the guest, he didn't want to break his word. And it's because of those who sat with him, those that he was around. He loved the glory of men more than the glory of God, and he was willing to compromise his principles in a horrifying fashion there. Now, I want to move quickly along to our next topic here of tragedy and troubles. Now, suffering is often used by those who are skeptical of our faith. It is a very common objection that people will raise. And I don't know if if you maybe view that as an easy out, but we certainly do find it difficult to satisfy people on that subject at times. And there are many who do become agnostic as they suffer these troubles and these difficulties. And there are others who perhaps don't change their belief patterns, but their lives do change because perhaps they turn to vices. They turn to some way to bury their sorrows. They're willing to compromise in other ways of behavior instead of just, say, turning their back on God completely. But suffering is certainly a stress test for us. It's quite a difficult challenge to put your faith through. Now, for those that would go through this and find that their faith is no longer of value to them, they become agnostic, they turn their back on God, it is an outcome that is a worldview based on a false premise. That is, it would seem to charge God with injustice. It would seem to charge God with the blame for the troubles that these people are going through. And on the other hand, it would also seem to give too much weight to the troubles they are going through above the blessings that God has given them throughout their lives. It fails also to see any benefit in the suffering. It fails to see that there is a reward, there is something that is worth living through and showing that you have the endurance to go through this. But you know, if you think about it, if a person loses faith over suffering that would, say, appear to be random, that person's not ready to face persecution. That is, if you have to go through these troubles, maybe health problems, maybe persecution, or some other kind of problems that are not persecution, if someone was doing that to you deliberately, do you really think you would be ready to stand up to that? I think not. But one of the other things that this does, this worldview, is it overlooks Christ's participation in our suffering because he entered into that suffering with us. And that's the example that's held up for us in Hebrews 12. That is, as we're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses, that is, these other heroes of faith who have lived up to the standard God has required of them, he says, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, but keep looking to Jesus and follow the pattern that he lived through because he kept his eyes on the reward. He thought little of the shame and the difficulties that he went through. And this would be helpful to us as well. Now, the next point I want to say is I want to be the first to point out that I don't speak with clout on this subject like many of you would. And so I'm simply going to repeat something that I heard from another preacher once who certainly did have the clout from his own personal experience and the difficulties that he and his family had gone through. And I'm just going to pass along what he had said. Because as he spoke on this subject, he made the statement that if a person falls away and turns his back on his faith and on God because of the troubles that he's lived through and the tragedies, whatever it is, there were issues with his faith before those troubles. That is, the troubles revealed a weak faith. They didn't cause it. And I do think that what he's saying is consistent with what we learn from the Bible. That is, just as we had talked about, it was the two houses that were seemingly of the same quality, but it's not until the storms came that you understand which one was ready for those conditions and which one wasn't. The storm didn't make the foundation poor, but it revealed that the foundation was inadequate. And I believe the same principle applies to what this other preacher once said. Now, you see, the troubles either reveal something very becoming of us or something not so becoming. And we have the example of Job, and we don't mean to really summarize the difficulties there other than to say, in a very short order, the loss of his family, the loss of his own health, in such a dramatic way is much more than I've seen someone have to endure personally. But you see, this is also the same kind of difficulty that Paul went through. That is, he had been in Asia. He said he despaired, basically, of any hope of living through some of those difficulties in 2 Corinthians 1. That is, he had resigned himself that his life was going to end. And yet, as he reflects back on some of this in the letter to the Corinthians, in 2 Corinthians 4, considering all those troubles that we go through, just to sum up, and we're not going to read all of these verses that go from that last paragraph of chapter 4 and into the first 10 verses of chapter 5. But he says, we do not lose heart. Our outer self is wasting away. Our inner self is being renewed day by day. This light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen, because it is those things that are unseen that are eternal. And that's what we need to focus on as well. That is, not why does this happen or that happen, but is there any benefit to enduring? And the Bible certainly tells us there's a resounding yes. Now, the next kind of pressure I want to talk about, the next kind of stress test, is this concept of when opportunity knocks. And what I'm talking about here is easily illustrated by an example in terms of, say, the proportionality of how difficult a temptation is to endure compared to your opportunity, or perceived opportunity even, of escaping. Now, you know, it would be really easy, I think, for a lot of us to get on a high horse and say, I've never stolen anything. And so we see people in the news that maybe got caught up in some kind of theft. Maybe they didn't hurt anyone physically, but that doesn't excuse them, of course. But, you know, I don't see that. And I think it's a mistake to view that as, well, I've never done that, and so I'm going to just have to sneer and not consider. Obviously, those people thought, with little exception, I realize there are exceptions where people become so desperate, they do things they don't actually expect to get away with. I recognize that. But don't you think most of the time when someone steals or robs a bank or whatever it is, he actually thought he could get away with it? That is, maybe conditions seemed to fall into place just right, that it was a little harder than usual, maybe a lot harder than usual, to resist under those circumstances. Many of us don't steal because the escape is unlikely. Now, I hope for those in this room, that's not the only reason we don't steal. But just recognize there are even heroes of the Bible, like King David, who, when he stayed home from war and a certain woman's husband was gone in the war, conditions fell into place that threw a challenge at him that he unfortunately wasn't ready for. So let's not get on our high horse and just get the idea that this will never happen to us. Because I assure you, Satan will do everything he can to present conditions for you that, if it makes any difference, might present a different outcome. So what if you thought no one will ever know? What if you truly thought you could get away with it? This is opportunity knocking. And the intensity of that perceived getaway and that the intensity of that temptation is going to go up proportionally. Now, you see that we also have situations for the positive and the negative that relate to this in the Bible, and we certainly aren't going to have time to look at a lot of them. But one of the very popular success stories is that of Joseph. That is, as he was put into an elevated position, it would have been quite easy as he was working for Potiphar in Egypt for his pride to have affected him. And then as he's being tempted by Potiphar's wife, he made it a point to not stress his faith more than had to be in that situation, because it says he was determined day by day not to spend time with her. He seemed to recognize that if opportunity knocks with just the right conditions, that's going to make such a temptation more difficult to live through. We need to have the same attitude as Joseph, but also the awareness. And much of what we're doing today is just raising awareness that many times you may be facing a stress test to your convictions without recognizing it. And so one of the best things we can do today is just raise awareness to that issue. And one of the things that may sneak up on us is this change in supervision. That is, you think about the Israelites, that while Moses was right there in front of them at Mount Sinai, there was no talk, apparently, of building an idol. But as soon as Moses goes away for a time on the mount, they hurry to Aaron and they say, as for this Moses, we don't know what's become of him. In other words, our level of supervision has changed, and now we're going to take advantage of that circumstance. But you see, Moses also reflects back on some of this and gives a warning for the future in Deuteronomy 31. Because he says, I know how rebellious and stubborn you are. Behold, even today, while I am yet with you, alive, you have been rebellious against the Lord. How much more after my death? Now, you see, as you age, and those of you that are still under the roof of your parents, if you've done well, that's good. But just recognize that at some point in your life, that level of supervision is going to take a different format. You may have a very different set of circumstances that presents opportunity that you need to be prepared for. Beware of a change in supervision. Now, we'll move on to another type here, and this has to do with something that stresses us from an external area, that is being provoked in some way. And this could apply emotional pressure that takes different forms, and we certainly can't look at all of those. But I think it's fair to say that people do provoke other people quite often. Now, this might happen because of something intentional, perhaps mistreating someone else. We've all seen that. We've also seen some kind of unfairness. We've seen inconsiderate actions toward others and even toward ourselves. And then there's just other types of aggression. Perhaps it's not a true mistreatment, but just say being around certain personality types might provoke you. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about here. It's easy to be provoked. Now, our instincts are often to respond in kind. Now, that's not good. I'm just saying that that is often the knee-jerk reaction. And that is, if someone harms you, it's so common to just do it back to him. After all, he deserves it. That is, someone smashes your foot, it's very natural to want to stomp on his as well. That's not the kind of action that's becoming of a child of God. And it's certainly not what we learn from Christ. Because as Jesus, again, was facing the cross itself, as he was led, Isaiah says, like a lamb to the slaughter, and like a sheep before its shearers is silent, he didn't open his mouth. That takes a tremendous amount of strength. But yet, that's the example that's held up for us. And if you find yourself not living up to this, don't dismiss it as, well, I was being provoked, or he deserved it. I'm not going to argue that. But that's not the example that is expected of us. We need to learn from those failures, because this is what Peter says in 1 Peter 2, verse 21 and following, that this is the example that is held up for us, that is Christ suffered, leaving you the steps to follow as well. And when he was reviled, he didn't revile in return. He suffered but didn't threaten, but he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. So there's a concept that's mentioned in 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, patiently endure all evil. Now, if a person is, say, going to mistreat you, and you find yourself tending to retaliate, are you ready to stand up to persecution? I don't think so. That is, if someone treats you unfairly, maybe does something to harm maybe all the nice work you've done on your house and your yard, and someone just out of spite goes with a weed eater and just destroys all of it, and you find yourself lashing out over that, you say, oh no, but if it was really persecution, I would be ready to endure that. No, you wouldn't. But let's not kid ourselves. We learned something here, that we had limits we maybe weren't aware of before that event. Don't retaliate. Now, the example that Paul teaches in 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, patiently endure all evil. Now, that's a challenging statement, but that's certainly what's expected of us. Now, there's along the same lines, the concept of controlling anger. Now, this is one that is tested in a variety of ways, because anger can be provoked on us by some kind of single event. And even if you endure that one event, it's also possible that there's this cumulative effect as one thing and another happens, maybe not even by the same people. But at some point, don't let that balloon pop just because there's a combination of pressure. And this is the kind of thing we even talked about in our lesson today in Proverbs 27, verses 15 and 16, that there's a continual dripping here that as it's presented here, it's in terms of a quarrelsome wife. Now, for purposes of our example, this wouldn't have to be from a wife. It could be from anyone who's trying to start a fight. But it could be like a continual dripping on a rainy day. Now, it says trying to restrain that is pointless. The restraint needs to be from within. Don't worry about what you can't control, but you can control this. Now, we have the same kind of principle taught in chapter 19. As we're talking about this whole spectrum of a single event that can provoke anger, or it could be a cumulative effect of various things. Proverbs 19, verse 13, I think, speaks to this. A foolish son is ruin to his father. Now, there could be a single event that some foolish person provokes you with and causes some kind of disaster. Or it could be something like the quarreling and the dripping of rain, that is, little by little, those defenses fall. There's these two big dangers to be aware of, the big events and the accumulation of small. But don't be moved more by anger than conviction, because ultimately it does boil down to that. At what point does that bridge break? Don't let it be as easy as it often could be. Now, another pressure we want to talk about is in terms of fear. And I find it interesting to think of the disciples in Matthew 4 as they were on the boat with Jesus and an actual storm, literally, challenged their faith. And they were about ready to give all hope up as this was happening. And Jesus still, under those circumstances, made no excuses for them. After all, you were afraid of dying. No, he says, you of little faith. That is, the pressure of fear is no excuse to losing your set of principles and your set of convictions. Self-preservation offers no excuses. And so ultimately it does boil down to, who is it you're truly afraid of? Some external force, or is it the Lord? Don't fear those who can kill merely the body, but fear him who can cast soul and body into hell. I want to talk about a different type of pressure here in terms of prosperity, because this is more of a, let's say, a soft kind of pressure, and of a totally different variety than the kind that we've just been discussing. And this also does harken back to the parable of the sower, because as it talks about the seed that fell among the thorns, these are the ones who go on their way, but they're choked by cares and riches and pleasure of life, and their fruit doesn't mature. Because even the desire for riches can overtake our focus. And one of the main ways that this happens is because riches, even the mere, just say, desire and focus on those things, exposes us to temptation. And that's part of the point of 1 Timothy 6, 9 and 10, the passage I think you're well familiar with. But if for no other reason, we tend to make commitments based on what we have the means to be a part of. And when a person is blessed with the means to do things, they tend to make those commitments, but that exposes us to compromise, doesn't it? You see, once you have these things, they could easily own us. And the anxiety of losing the means to maintain this standard of living that we've committed ourselves to or started to be attached to, it exposes us to compromise. Moses warned about the same kind of thing, about the concept of self-sufficiency and pride in the book of Deuteronomy. He says, beware once you go into this land that you didn't plant the vineyards, you didn't build the cities. You're going to live in a very prosperous lifestyle, not because of your own doing, but beware lest you turn your back on the Lord and forget the one who's made all of these things available. And then Nehemiah, in his majestic prayer of chapter 9, thinks back on all of this and points out that's exactly what happened. This prosperity posed a challenge to their faith from a totally different variety, but its effect was no less devastating. The complacency, self-sufficiency, and pride all are a different type of stress altogether, and they can sneak up upon us without even being aware of it. Now, I want to talk about this in terms of a combination of events as well. That is, as we were saying, when a bridge is built, and they say, well, the bridge stands up even with 10 cars at a time. And then you show, well, even 10 dump trucks. Okay, that's good. And then under the heaviest load of traffic we could expect, to pass over this bridge. That's good. What about in high winds? You know, there could be a combination of stresses, and this happens with financial institutions too. That is, they don't need to focus so much on one risk that they are unprepared if economic conditions throw multiple challenges at the same time, because that's often when things break down. The same kind of thing could happen to your faith. That is, you might pass certain tests in isolation. That's good. But vulnerabilities increase when multiple challenges face us at the same time. I'm not sure who to point to that Satan challenged more in this way than Job, because Job certainly shows us that Satan doesn't simply, when he's determined to take you down, he doesn't go with one challenge at a time. He threw everything. He threw the kitchen sink at him. And that's the kind of pressure we need to be prepared to face as well. Unfortunately, some people can't even face a small drip without folding. And you take Samson, a man who was, I guess he was stronger than anyone in the world when the Spirit of God was with him. And yet, he was taken down by this continual drip of the harlot Delilah that was determined to find out how to bring about his demise. And that should have been entirely obvious to him, what she was trying to do. And he held out for a while. But the way it says it in Judges 16, verse 16, the strongest man in the world, at least physically, it says, when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him, his soul was vexed to death. He folded under this constant drip. It wasn't just one time he passed, two times he passed, but he had a limit, and he wasn't prepared for it as much as he thought. Now, back to our passage in 2 Timothy 2, verse 24, I just want to make another point about this, that suppose a man and his wife go out to eat, and maybe he faces poor service that day. Unfortunately, the waitress spills a pitcher of drink on him, and he takes it patiently. Then they bring him his food, and it's not the right meal. Then she brings him the right meal, and it's cold. Then it's time to pay for his meal, and she overcharged him. And, you know, he's taken all of this pretty well so far, but now after all of this, he's finally met his limits. And unfortunately, he lets her know how unhappy he was about it. He lets her have it. Now, there's nothing becoming about that. After all, he went through a lot. No, don't kid yourself. Perhaps later that day, he goes to the local congregation where they attend. They're having a gospel meeting. And guess who happens to be there too? An outside visitor, a waitress at the same restaurant that he went. Uh-oh, I don't think she's going to sign up for a Bible study. This man has an important responsibility here. And he should have learned something that, you know, this was a really revealing event about his faith. Patiently endure all evil. If you can't even handle an accumulation of these stresses against you, you're not ready for persecution. You're not ready for something really serious. Someone said, well, if the stakes were bigger, I would be ready. No, you wouldn't. If your roof leaks under a light rain, you're not ready for monsoon season either. And it's a very sobering realization as we think about that. There's a lot asked of us. Don't fold under one or two events. Don't fold under an accumulation of them either. But as you fall, recognize there is a deficiency revealed here, something that needs to be fixed, something that needs to be addressed, and learn from it. And God has grace that is willing to pardon and to help you through those weaknesses. Yes, of course. But this testing is necessary, and this is something that we must learn from. We have some follow-up applications that I don't think we're going to have time to deal with today. But just to understand that testing has an improved product. Testing is for an outcome of good. Testing is regulated by God. God doesn't allow us to be tested more than what we are able. But testing is for good. It's not merely for pain. And the Bible has so much to say about these things. Now, there's things that we can do about it, and there's what we can't do. What you can't do is outsource your testing to someone else. You can't transfer it to somebody else. An assessment of your faith has to be made, and you are the only one who can put up with that. But you also can't avoid these things either. And that is, we've got to have a better strategy than simply, here's someone that upsets me, I'm just going to stay away from him. Well, that might work for a while, but you've got to have a better strategy than that. Other people are going to upset you. There are other people that are going to provoke you. Some of them are determined to do so. You've got to be ready beyond that. But that's also not to say that we should subject ourselves to trials and temptations more than what is necessary. Satan will test you enough. Don't help him. Don't give him more opportunity than is necessary. And as the psalmist writes in Psalm 101, verse 3, I will set no wicked thing before my eyes, nothing worthless. That is, don't put challenges in your own path that are unnecessary. Instead, make straight the crooked paths. Remove the obstacles from before you. And just to follow up on the lesson we've been talking about, I think Jesus in Luke 16 refers to the same concept we were talking about. These little deficiencies reveal bigger deficiencies were present you may not have been aware of. He says, he who is faithful in little is faithful also in much. That is, you don't kid yourself into thinking, well, if it was a bigger challenge, then I would be faithful. No, if you find yourself tripping over the little things, you're going to trip over the big things too. But that was a very valuable lesson to learn and something that we all need to work on. It may be there's someone in our audience today that is in need of obeying the gospel, someone that has not put on Christ in baptism. We want you to realize that there are people that are with you here today that are ready to help. He who believes and is baptized will be saved. He who believes not will be condemned. It could be that you've done this in the past and you have some corrections to make and you'd like the help of the brethren in doing so. There are plenty of people here that are ready and willing to do so. And if there's a way we can help you publicly, won't you come forward while we stand and sing?